everybody, and welcome to the Daily Report. I'm John Arola. Today's debate day, which is always a good follow-up to impeachment day. I wonder what they'll talk about. So look, we've got a lot that we're gonna cover today on the show. We've got Donald Trump reacting to the impeachment, not substantively, but he has a hissy fit, and it's pretty cruel and horrific, so we're gonna cover that. But importantly, with this debate coming up, one of the last debates that we have before the primary and caucus season starts, I have got a holiday themed Christmas wish list for each of the 7 candidates that have made it onto the stage tonight. So I'm gonna be revealing that to you. But also, we have 2 guests. And so over the past couple of weeks, we have featured 2 viral campaign ads, one about climate change, one about gun control. And in both cases, we invited the candidates to come on and talk about those ads. And so Eddie Morrow and Andrew Romanoff, both Democratic Senate candidates, will be on the show today to talk about those ads and the issues that they were trying to highlight. We've also got, meanwhile, in news from Australia, India, and Bangladesh, so you're not gonna wanna miss that. But we start off with the insanity of Donald Trump. Donald Trump, as the impeachment was going on, was giving a rally, and he talked about a lot of things. But one thing he decided to bring up was a fairly vicious and cruel attack against deceased Representative John Dingell. Here's what he said.
Then you have this Dingell. You know Dingell from Michigan? You know Dingell? You ever hear of her, Michigan? Debbie Dingell, that's a real beauty. So she calls me up like 8 months ago. Her husband was here a long time. But I didn't give him the B treatment. I didn't give him the C or the D. I could have. Nobody would have, you know. I gave the A-plus treatment. Take down the flags. She calls me up. It's the nicest thing that's ever happened. Thank you so much. John would be so thrilled. He's looking down. He'd be so thrilled. Thank you so much, sir. I said, that's okay. Don't worry about it. Maybe he's looking up, I don't know. Maybe.
Okay, so let's run through the issues there. First and smallest, did you ever hear? Yes, in Michigan, they've heard of the Dingells. It's kind of a big name there. Might be important in the upcoming election. First says, what a beauty. Just casually insults her appearance, because to Donald Trump, the only thing that matters about a woman is whether he gets turned on when he looks at her. But even that, not nearly the worst thing. So he says, I didn't give him the B treatment, the C treatment. I could have, nobody would have, and then cuts off. He's a Christian, okay? He says, who else thinks I could have been needlessly cruel to a person who had died, but I didn't. I would have gotten away with it. I didn't do that. What part of Christianity is that? What, like, remember compassionate conservatism? Man, that died too a long time ago, and he'd probably think the same things about it. So then he goes through the phone call that he had with Debbie Dingell. So this is a woman who had just lost her husband of many, many, many years, and he play acts that she was happy that he lowered the flags. Like he puts on an affect, like he does her voice. I'm not a psychologist, I'm not a psychiatrist or anything like that. But that combined with the Lisa Page thing where he's like mimicking people having sex, it's like he's some sort of alien who finds emotional experiences that other people are having to be a form of bizarre entertainment. Like, he doesn't experience emotions, and so he finds it weird when someone would be sad, for instance. And like, let's say he hadn't said the thing implying that deceased John Dingell is literally burning in hell right now. If he hadn't done that, it would be really bizarre that he was playing as if he was a widow who had just lost his husband. That's bizarre. And then there's the hell thing. So what did John Dingell do that made Trump mad? Presumably he was a Democrat and then he died. Is there anything about Dingell in the news right now that would lead Trump to think about him? Not even in a negative way, just at all. Not that I know of. It's a bizarre, weird tick that he has that when he's under pressure, he decides to start launching insane attacks. And I will say, while there were cheers when he said that, people in the crowd were cheering at the prospect that this former congressman was burning for all eternity, which is bizarre. I think that even if you're a Christian, you generally aren't happy about the prospect of people being in hell. I'm not a Christian, but that's generally what I believe to be true. It didn't receive the sort of response that some of his attacks have. And I'm not saying that he's reached some sort of line that they won't cross. A lot were still cheering, but they seemed a little bit uncomfortable with the entire thing. So that's them. Remember, they're not deplorable. They just laugh at the prospect that a guy who died is in hell as he is attacking the widow. Well, the widow also tweeted, Representative Debbie Dingell tweeted, "Mr. President, let's set politics aside. My husband earned all of his accolades after a lifetime of service. I'm preparing for the first holiday season without the man I love. You brought me down in a way you can never imagine, and your hurtful words just made my healing much harder." So as a normal person, I read that and I think, look, I don't know much about Debbie Dingell, and it doesn't matter. I know that when you have lost someone that you've loved for years and years, my heart goes out to you. Even if you were my enemy, my heart would go out to you. And that is not the case here. So she expresses that she has been badly hurt by this because she too is an emotionally normal, stable person. But the bizarre thing is, like, I couldn't look it up because I couldn't take seeing it. But I have a feeling that for all that many of his fans might have liked him casually implying that a guy who had died is in hell, I bet they liked her tweet. Because the idea is they want libs to be hurt. That's why the joke is funny. And her reaction where she says she was hurt is just confirmation of what they want. And I know that this seems like a weird thing to focus on, but do you think that like Don Jr. read this tweet and thought, I'm a little bit ashamed of my dad? That's a really weird thing. I mean, look, even if I support him on this impeachment thing, I don't think he should be impeached. I like him, I like his policies. What the hell is this? What have we become as a movement? What have we become as a party? But they must like this. They must like the confirmation that they got to someone. Even if it's someone they don't know, they don't know anything about them, they just want them to hurt. It's a really weird time. So Stephanie Grisham, who is technically the press secretary, although you wouldn't know because they don't do press conferences, she was on Good Morning America and she was asked about this. Now take a look at her BS argument for why we should not be appalled at what Trump did.
Will the president apologize to the Dingell family?
I haven't spoken to the president about that. I would say that I am very, very sorry for her loss. And I would thank her and I would thank her late husband for all of the service to our country. The president did lower the flags at the White House to half staff to do everything he could to honor him at her request. So we'll see what happens from there. We do thank them for their service. And again, very, very sorry for her
loss. Why do you think the president said that overnight?
You'd have to talk to the president about that. He was at a political rally. He has been under attack and under impeachment attack for the last few months and then just under attack politically for the last 2.5 years. I think that as we all know, the president is a counterpuncher. It was a very, very supportive and wild crowd. And he was just riffing on some of the things that had been happening the past few days.
Every one of those arguments from Stephanie Grisham right there are so incredibly sad and dishonest. It was a wild and supportive crowd. So of course he's going to say that a dead congressman's in hell, presumably. She didn't finish the sentence, but what does that mean? It's a wild and supportive crowd. So you can say whatever he wants. You can threaten to kill someone. It's a wild and supportive crowd. They liked it, so that makes it right. Things are moral. Things are acceptable if at least 10,000 people clap when you say it. That's just how the world works. Again, this is the party that says they have a book that is a perfect manual for morality. But anything goes, and especially anything goes if we can just say that he's a counterpuncher. Okay, so what is a counterpuncher supposed to mean the way they're using it? It's that he didn't just walk up and punch someone, he was punched, so he punches back. Okay, that does not, again, make things moral. I think that Jesus specifically talked about what you should do if you're struck. He was fairly specific about it, by the way, and there wasn't much counterpunching in his advice. But okay, so he's a counterpuncher. So what did deceased Representative John Dingell recently do to Trump to cause him to punch against him? Nothing, he's been dead for months and months. So what did the widow do? God only knows. Best case scenario, if you actually think that labeling someone a counterpuncher makes what they do less horrendous, then this is just he is facing pressure over impeachment and so he's counterpunching. So that is saying that if someone is under pressure, anything they do, no matter how horrible, no matter how disconnected from the pressure they're facing, becomes acceptable. All of these people, the representatives of Donald Trump, the defenders of Donald Trump, are talking about him the way a parent who has horrifically spoiled their child would defend their actions. There is no defense. There's no rational defense. The counterpuncher thing can be applied in any situation. They use it for literally everything. And I don't, so I know that talking about this at all is probably a waste of time, but I feel like at some point someone needs to stand up for decency. I don't want vicious, ridiculous, insane attacks to be just everyday news, to go uncriticized, to just say, well, look, everybody is counterpunching. Anything goes. Everybody's in hell. Every congressman or congresswoman can be just ignored because they're not physically attractive enough. What a world, weird world we're being brought into with politicians like Donald Trump and sociopaths like Stephanie Grisham in this particular case. Okay, we're gonna move on. We've got Eddie Morrow, US Senate candidate in Iowa, is gonna be joining us after this to talk about his recent campaign ad. We'll see you in just a little bit.
We need to talk about a relatively new show called the Republic, or UNFTR. As a Young Turks fan, you already know that the government, the media, and corporations are constantly peddling lies that serve the interests of the rich and powerful. But now there's a podcast dedicated to unraveling those lies, debunking the conventional wisdom. In each episode of the Republic, or UNFTR, the host delves into a different historical episode or topic that's generally misunderstood or purposely obfuscated by the so-called powers that be, featuring in-depth research, razor-sharp commentary, and just the right amount of vulgarity. The UNFTR podcast takes a sledgehammer to what you thought you knew about some of the nation's most sacred historical cows. But don't just take my word for it. The New York Times described UNFTR as consistently compelling and educational, aiming to challenge conventional wisdom and upend the historical narratives that were taught in school. For as the great philosopher Yoda once put it, "You must unlearn what you have learned." And that's true whether you're in Jedi training or you're uprooting and exposing all the propaganda and disinformation you've been fed over the course of your lifetime. So search for UNFDR in your podcast app today and get ready to get informed, angered, and entertained all at the same time.
I'm a product of the stones igniting a light beam to split between dreams and snares of nice kicks. I'm a product.
Not long ago, we profiled a campaign ad that was going viral. It was for candidate Eddie Morrow, US Senate candidate for Iowa. And in the ad, he was speaking about a number of issues, including gun control, as his Republican opponent, Joni Ernst, apparently is firing shots at him. Now, this generated a lot of conversation. And in our coverage of it, we asked Eddie Morrow to come on the show and talk about it. And so now I am very glad to welcome onto the show US Senate candidate Eddie Morrow. Welcome to the Damage Report.
Thanks, John. Thanks for having me on today.
Glad to have you here. So we want to talk a lot about a lot of different issues, but let's start off with the ad. When you were putting it together, did you have the idea that this would probably generate a lot of conversation, some of it not necessarily supportive?
Absolutely. We need to go have some hard conversations sometimes to move the ball forward. The intention was to bring about a conversation and to bring about action on issues that are very important to Americans today. And today in Washington, the problems that are facing Americans just aren't being addressed, John, with the urgency, the courage that this moment in time is asking of us. And because of that, I'm the best progressive Democrat, the strongest candidate to take on Joni Ernst in 2020.
And I want to talk about your platform and why you believe that you're the strongest to go against her in just a minute. Just a little bit more on, so we discussed your ad. She had her ad a number of years back where she rolls up on a motorcycle and she starts blasting away with a gun. It's become like a standard thing where if you're a Republican candidate, at some point you're going to have a campaign ad where you're shooting a stack of papers or cooking bacon at it or something like that. And considering how many people are killed every year with guns, how many of these guns are designed to kill people, it's interesting that the ad that actually has them being used the way they're designed to be used, which is aiming at and firing at humans, that's the one that generates the negative pushback, not the one where it's sanitized, they're shooting at paper or whatever. What do you think about that?
Well, I gotta tell you, When I was shooting that ad, the days that we were doing that, you see me walking up the hill in the clip you just showed. I was thinking back to the time when I was a teacher. I'm thinking about the kids in Parkland, those teachers in Parkland. I'm thinking about my wife and I being parents. I'm thinking about those parents in Sandy Hook and Newtown who just this past week remembered dreadfully the 7th anniversary of losing their kids. I'm thinking about my own children that go out to nightclubs or they go to concerts and thinking about them not coming home someday. So it was meant to be a hard-hitting ad, and I'm disappointed that Joni Ernst and the NRA and Fox News came out with this kind of fake appallousness and disgust. What's really disgusting and appalling is that Joni Ernst takes $3.1 million from the NRA.
Wow.
That she cannot come to the table and have a conversation then about protecting our kids, our communities from gun violence.
Yeah. So the House has passed gun control legislation. It has not been taken up by the Senate. Mitch McConnell has no interest. If you were to defeat Joni Ernst, there's a better chance that Mitch McConnell is no longer the majority leader. If we do get Democratic control of the Senate and you're involved in the crafting of gun control legislation, what would you like to see done?
No, we would like to do what Chief Justice Antonin Scalia did. Let's respect the Second Amendment, but also let's reduce gun violence in our communities. Let's make sure we have background checks. Let's look to have licensing initiatives for all guns that are sold out there. Let's go back and reinstate the assault weapons ban that we had for 10 years, that the data demonstrated we reduced gun violence in our communities, and the world did not end. Not everybody lost, everybody didn't lose their guns at that time. The Second Amendment is still alive and well, even with a ban like that. There's so much we can be doing. We need to go study first and foremost, to go invest dollars in the CDC on what gun violence is doing in our communities, and then come up with some ideas. And it's puzzling that that the Republicans won't even allow that to happen so we can figure out what the best pathway is forward. That's disappointing. Americans deserve better leadership than that. They're not getting that from Joni Ernst. They're not getting that from Mitch McConnell. And that's why we're here.
So what are the people of Iowa getting from Joni Ernst? What has she been doing in the past few years in that seat?
She's not getting any, they're not getting anything, Iowa or America. You know, Joni Ernst is a senator for special interest. She's a senator for big industry, for fat cats like the Koch brothers. She sold out Iowa in this country from the get-go. Her ads, she had two good ads. People thought they were nice ads. The one that we used in our show, the Make 'em Squeal ad, they got lots of accolades, but she failed to perform. She's not helping Iowans improve their health care. She's not tackling the climate crisis that's in front of us, that's threatening our homes and our farms, our communities, and the future for our kids and our grandkids. We've already talked about gun violence, where she's not interested in helping improve our communities from gun violence. On education, she sold out our farmers by being in Donald Trump's back pocket all the time. Most recently, when it came to the renewable fuel standard, she had a chance to stand up and say, President Trump, we need your help. Stop lying to us, stop misleading us and conning us. We got a trade war out there that's hurting Iowa farmers and agricultural people. I'm not finding a place where she's been on the side of real people in this country.
Yeah.
Only special interest, big industry, and our friends, the Koch brothers.
I want to talk to you about one other aspect of your platform. A lot of candidates don't necessarily have much detail in what they want to do when it comes to the climate crisis. On your website, you actually do have quite a bit of details, but there aren't actually mentions of the Green New Deal, which has become sort of one of the standard policies that a lot of candidates are supporting. Why is it that you're not talking explicitly about a Green New Deal?
No, I'm supportive of the Green New Deal. Okay. We're talking more specifically, especially in Iowa, about what we can be doing. Iowa should be at the forefront of the climate solutions. Regenerative agriculture, carbon sequestration, cap and trade. Our rural communities in Iowa and other like states in the Midwest and around the country should be at the forefront of fixing our climate. In the midst of that, John, then we're creating tens of thousands of jobs in our communities. Our farmers find a new source of income, which uplifts our main streets, our town squares. There's so much to be gained from that. We have the strongest climate coalition that's now stretching across the country. We got a very strong climate policy and position. We want to go tackle this issue. Of all the things we're talking about, we talked about gun safety earlier. We'll probably talk about some other things. If we don't address this issue, none of the other ones matter.
Okay. Well, Eddie Murrow, a Senate candidate in Iowa, want to thank you again for joining us. Maybe we can talk a little bit later on in your run against Joni Ernst.
I'd love to be back on again. And thanks for giving me a chance today. Thanks,
awesome.
John.
Thank you. We're going to take a short break here. When we come back, the big Democratic debate coming up tonight. I've got requests for each one of the seven candidates, and I'll break those down after this. tonight, not far actually from where we're filming this, there will be a Democratic debate, and it's a pretty big one because we don't have a lot more before Iowa and New Hampshire. They're coming up fast, and for candidates who want to break into that top three, top four, there's a the window is closing on that. And so if you're gonna go big, this is a pretty good time to do it. And so for each of the seven candidates, and seven did qualify, I am going to give my sort of Christmas wish list, what I would like them to do. And it's gonna be a balance of two things. I am going to try to give advice to each of these candidates for how they could actually improve their chances. Obviously, I don't support six of these candidates, but I'm gonna try to be helpful. Although I do have to acknowledge that I'm gonna be coming at it from a particular bias, since there is one of the candidates that I do support. Let's start off with Joe Biden. He is the current leader in the race. He has been the leader in the race for many months at this point, something like 9 months. What he needs to do if he actually wants to win is not do what he's been doing, which is either not talk. He's like if the moderators start to cut him off, he stops talking. No other candidate does that. He just says, okay, I'm done. Don't do that, because that does not show a fighting spirit. I know that people believe that you're the most electable against Donald Trump, but you have to be willing to fight it out with people who mostly agree with you on a lot of things to prove to us that you're willing to fight it out with someone who's gonna be coming hard against you the entire debate. So talk, actually talk, show that you wanna talk, show that you wanna talk about your platform. It might not be a bad idea to come up with some good plans to talk about, and to talk less about things like corn pop and crazy, like weird ranty stories. Talk about your policies, try to actually sell them. What I want out of this race is for it to be about the actual substance. So that's for Biden. For Bernie, who is in second place right now, he's been back in second place for a little bit since he eclipsed Elizabeth Warren. I know that the last thing you wanna do, the last thing you are, based on your personality, predisposed to do is to go on the attack. I get it. Because even when you don't attack, people call you crotchety and, you know, like friction and all that stuff. And if you do, they will attack you. But the time has come. Biden is still winning. You have got to go on the offensive against Joe Biden. I assumed that the American people would just sort of catch on. They do not appear to be doing that. And they still think that he is a shoo-in to beat Donald Trump. And so if you want to show that you are the better candidate based on the policies, and since, look, full disclosure, I've endorsed you, I think that you are, you have to make that case. You can't just counterpunch, you gotta go on the attack against Joe Biden. So please do that, Bernie. For Elizabeth Warren, you were up until recently in second place in this race. You've been passed now by Bernie Sanders. A lot of people who might have either supported you earlier or been interested in you, even if you weren't their first choice, believe that you have backtracked on some of the core progressive policies that you've been staking your candidacy around. Now, for some of those people, there's nothing you can say that would reassure them, but it is still on you to do that. And so, giving an impassioned, no holds barred defense of Medicare for all, the Green New Deal, these sorts of things, that might help to reassure some of the people who've recently moved from supporting you, perhaps to Pete Buttigieg, to Biden, those sorts of things. So keep it on the issues and speak positively about what you plan to do. No quibbling. Next, for Buttigieg. Look, you've been facing a lot of pressure recently, Pete Buttigieg, and a lot of it has to do with the fact that you are accepting money from the sorts of people that a lot of Democratic primary voters do not want having a strong voice in this primary. It took a lot of pressure for you to open up your fundraisers to the press. It took a lot of pressure for you to disclose your bundlers. And even then, you left 20 of them off. It took more pressure to get you to reveal those. What you need to do is go beyond disclosure. Stop taking money from extremely wealthy people who have no interest in systematic change in this country. They're not on our side, and you need to prove that you are. As long as you're being financed by them, as long as you're spending your time going to Wall Street to get money and then wine caves and things like that, it is gonna be very hard for a lot of people to believe that you actually have their best interest in mind. So coming out and rejecting all of that money in the future, giving that money back, that would be the strongest move at this point that I think you could make. Next to Andrew Yang. Andrew Yang, I know that the moderators don't have a lot of interest in letting you talk. I get that. And it's possible that you can speak up and they just won't go to you, but you gotta try. Andrew Yang has spoken the least, I believe, every debate so far. And they're not gonna just give you that time. They're not gonna hand it over to you. You need to take it. You need to speak out. Maybe you need to scream. Maybe you need to throw a fit or something like that. There are a lot of people who have an issue with this format. They might be on your side, but they're not going to be on your side unless you make it clear on the stage what your side is. So if you want to have the time to talk about your platform, you need to be more aggressive than anyone has been on that stage to claim that time as your own. For Amy Klobuchar, what are you doing? Come on. You qualified. Congratulations. That is a surprise because there's a lot of people in the race right now that are still at 0% and they're hanging in there. They're still running. There's like 10 people who are running who have literally no measurable support. Amy Klobuchar does have a couple of points of support. I don't support Amy Klobuchar, but if I did, I would say you have got to differentiate yourself from Pete Buttigieg and Joe Biden. They're your competition right now for those centrist establishment voters. If you want them, you gotta come up with something exciting. You have to be the centrist version of Elizabeth Warren. Come up with some kind of plan. It can't just be, I agree with Biden and Buttigieg, I'm just kind of quieter about it. That is not gonna work. Come up with something. I don't know what it is because I don't come up with centrist policy proposals, but you gotta stand out with something big and it's not gonna be cracking like jokes or something like that. That is not working for you. Make it about the substance, but come up with what that substance is going to be. And then finally, Tom Steyer. Tom Steyer, of the three billionaires in this race, I agree with the most. What I disagree with is him running for the presidency in the first place. Tom Steyer, I believe, to the extent that a billionaire can sort of have like the right intentions, and I think that every billionaire is warped by the money that they have. I think that he does, but he's just wrong to be running. Tom Steyer, you're not gonna win the presidency, and you are spending so much money to lose this primary. That money could be put into a million different better uses. And I know that you're putting money into other things too, but put this money as well. Fight voter suppression. Help to win some state houses so that we can get rid of gerrymandering and things like that. Like, there is an assault on democracy across this country, and you could be the champion that fights against it. I know that you wanna make climate change a big part of this race, and I do value that. But we've got Bernie, he's doing it too. You could be the guy that helps to retake these state house races that the Republicans have been so successful in over the past couple of decades. And that is a far better use of your money than what you're doing right now. So that is the advice that I have for those candidates. It really is go time. And we're gonna be doing live coverage later tonight. Hopefully you'll tune in right after the debate. We'll be giving our responses, Jake and Anna and Ida and myself. Super consequential, and so it's very interesting to see what they end up doing, if they take any of my advice, which I believe many of them will not. So we're gonna take a short break. When we come back, Andrew Romanoff, Senate candidate in Colorado, is gonna be here to talk about climate change and other issues after this. One candidate is trying to make climate change one of the core issues. That is Andrew Romanoff, Senate candidate in Colorado, who had a video go viral recently, although it was criticized quite a bit as well. And when we showed you the video last week, we asked him to come on the show and talk about the issue. And what do you know? Here he is, Andrew Romanoff. Welcome to the Damage Report.
Thanks so much, John. I appreciate it. Why am I following a Komodo dragon and a velociraptor? What should I read out of that?
We're a weird network. I'm not going to lie to you. It is weird. Thank you for coming on the show. Sure. We really enjoyed the ad. I do want to issue one correction. I had sort of been recollecting when we covered that I thought that Cory Booker had made one of his sort of classic sort of dad joke type jokes about the ad. I had misremembered it was Cory Gardner, a very different person. So
yes.
Apologies for that mistake.
No worries. You should apologize probably to Cory Booker.
Probably. Well, I'll ask him to come on. So look, you made the ad. It's about climate change. For the most part, it's talking about the present day, the horrific extreme weather events and all of that. The beginning is a sort of futuristic scenario. Tell me about the choice to portray a future that might happen if we don't deal with the climate crisis seriously.
Well, it's a future that is happening now. Look, if you're one of the families who have been devastated by this climate crisis, I don't think that the scenario we portrayed at the beginning of that video looks too unrealistic. The truth is, millions of folks around the world are being uprooted from their homes, as you know, John, and turned out of storms and floods and droughts and heat waves and wildfires, forced to flee. This is a crisis, and it's not a distant threat. As we said, it's here, it's real, it's now, and we need to change course.
You know, I saw, we showed in our coverage of your ad, there were a few articles talking about it that said, it's an interesting ad, but is it wise to run based on fear, to fear monger in this way? What do you think about that? To describe your portrayal of what's happening when it comes to climate as being akin in some ways to the other ways that politicians have tried to run on fear about things like immigration, terrorism, things like that.
Well, we're running on the hope of a Green New Deal. I support that plan. My opponent, one of the opponents, at least in this Democratic primary, John Hickenlooper, does not. Cory Gardner does not. In fact, Governor Hickenlooper, who is a Democrat, describes the Green New Deal and Medicare for All and a number of other progressive priorities as akin to the work of not just Karl Marx, but Joseph Stalin.
Wow.
That's terrifying. We're never going to get the changes we need if we continue to echo the talking points of the opposition. So I'm glad that more than 300 elected officials across the state have endorsed our campaign. I'm glad that we have built the sort of broad grassroots effort we're going to need to beat Cory Gardner. But first, we've got to tackle the folks in our own team who are thwarting our progress.
So let's say you win, you get into the Senate. What do you plan to do when it comes to confronting this crisis?
But this is the fundamental moral test of our time. It is an existential threat, as you know, John. So we've laid out a platform that includes ending the $650 billion a year we're spending now in direct and indirect subsidies for oil and gas and coal, putting that instead into renewable energy, into energy efficiency, transforming our electrical grid, our transportation system, our building codes, putting millions of Americans to work, building a clean energy infrastructure. The good news is, we can both protect our environment and grow our economy at the same time. Colorado is leading the way. The trouble is, of course, a state can't save a planet. We need an international commitment to this cause, and I want the US to lead.
And one of the big goals, for instance, in the Green New Deal, it says by 2050, we should be net zero greenhouse gas emissions. When do you think we should reach that target?
As soon as possible. I think we could get there sooner. I'd like the US to lead so that we can help other nations meet that target as well. If you go to AndrewRomanoff.com, you look at our priority page, you'll find a very ambitious agenda. A lot of folks said, well, this is too fast. We can't do all of this. I think they underestimate the ingenuity of the American people. They don't understand, for example, the original New Deal when we faced a pair of existential threats, both the Axis powers and a Great Depression. And we summoned the courage we needed to transform our economy, to meet that threat, to save civilization itself. These are the stakes. And what we need is a group of women and men in the United States Senate with the courage of our convictions. I wish that the folks in Washington understood that. We need to move them out of the way.
So look, you're obviously looking ahead to some extent against Gardner, but you've got this primary. How are you outside of obviously the big differences between you and the opponents on climate change, in other issues, how are you seeking to differentiate yourself?
Well, on Medicare for All, which I support, Governor Hickenlooper opposes. We've laid out an agenda here based in part on the experience I bring. I was the Speaker of the House, as you know, John, in Colorado for 4 years, led the Democrats here to our first majority in 30 years. I also spent the last 4 years leading a mental health organization on behalf of families who face mental illness or drug addiction, or in some cases suicide, which devastated my family. And I am not content to stand by while more Americans struggle and suffer and die on account of problems that we can fix, or on account of the indifference of an insurance industry that bases its profits on its ability to deny as many claims and exclude as many sick people as possible. It's a good business model, I suppose, if you're an insurance company. It's a pretty lousy model for the rest of us.
Yeah.
Governor Hickenlooper opposes Medicare for All. I support it.
Well, part of that business model, both for the insurance companies, pharmaceutical companies, but for fossil fuel generating companies as well, is to donate to political campaigns. And there's a lot of politicians that still take massive amounts of money from both of those industries. Not all of them are Republicans. What do you think about Democrats who still take significant amount of campaign finance dollars from the people that theoretically they are willing to regulate, perhaps not to the same extent that you are, but they do speak out against these industries while many of them are funded, at least in part, by them?
Yeah, it's a conflict of interest that we're avoiding because we don't take contributions from the fossil fuel industry or any other special interest groups. I should acknowledge, John, they're not offering. If you're a big oil company or an insurance company or a drug company, you've got other choices in this race. John Hickenlooper scratched his name off of the no fossil fuel money pledge. Very hard for me to understand how you will portray yourself or act as a climate champion if you're subsidized by the same industry you're supposed to be regulating. And it's no great surprise. Governor Hickenlooper sued communities here in Colorado that tried to restrict fracking and protect their public health. He literally, as you can see in our ad, drank the fracking fluid. So yeah. If we're serious about replacing Cory Gardner with a climate champion and leading the fight for a Green New Deal, we've got to win this Democratic nomination. Yeah. And I hope that folks who are watching will help.
And where can people find out more about your campaign?
Funny, friendly question. So folks can go online at andrewromanoff.com, andrewromanoff.com. They can watch the ad, they can contribute. We're trying to raise as much as we can before the end of the year, because we're up against not just, as you said, the Republican Party, Cory Gardner, Mitch McConnell, Donald Trump, who's about to come and campaign for Gardner here in Colorado, but also the Democratic Senatorial Campaign Committee, which recruited Governor Hickenlooper into this race, even though Hicks said he didn't want the job and wouldn't be good at it. No. I believe him, by the way.
That is true, actually. I'd forgotten about that. Okay, well, Andrew Romanoff, thank you for joining us. Also, thank you for making climate change front and center in your campaign. Really do appreciate that. Wish more candidates would do that.
Thanks, John. I appreciate it.
Okay, we're going to take a short break here when we come back. Meanwhile, in news from around the world after this. And now it's time for news from around the world. It's Meanwhile In. Meanwhile, in Australia, that kangaroo would probably be on fire, tragically, because the insane heat wave and brush fires have not abated since we last spoke about them on the show a few weeks ago. It is horrendous. In fact, record setting. So let's go through a few of the issues we're dealing with right now. Almost 2,000 firefighters were battling 108 separate blazes across New South Wales on Monday. That's earlier this week, ahead of extreme heat forecasts for much of Australia throughout the rest of the week. So we're now in that rest of the week. And you want to know how bad it was? It was 2 days ago, Australia set a record for the hottest day at this time of the year. But they weren't satisfied with that. The next day, they broke that record then. This is absolutely horrendous. It had already been horrible for months at this point. I mean, we talked about the koalas a few weeks ago. Many houses burned down. This is a horrible, horrible set of fires. Literally dozens raging at any given time. And it doesn't look likely to abate anytime soon, considering how hot it is. Areas of inland South Australia are forecast to have 5 consecutive days of 113 degrees or hotter temperatures, with 3 higher than 116.6 degrees. Multiple days of that sort of heat. You want to know what it looks like in a heat map of the country? Take a look at this from earlier this week. That's a lot of red. That's the brown too. where it's not red, it's brown. Those are horrible temperatures over the vast majority of Australia. And you know, I told you about over 100 fires burning at one point earlier this week. Take a look at a map, a satellite photo of the country. You can see huge plumes of smoke from many separate fires all at the same time. Now, to zoom out just a little bit, last year was the hottest on record for most of the states in Australia, with major heat waves in December and January. And heat waves are now becoming more common, getting hotter and lasting longer. Scientists in Australia could be facing, quote, a dangerous new normal. And so look, this is obviously horrible for Australia. It's also emblematic of what we've been seeing all over the world over the past few years. I mean, here in California, we have fires nearly constantly. Many parts of the United States do. But Europe had a horrendous heat wave. Spain had horrible fires earlier this year. The Arctic was on fire earlier this year. This new normal, don't consider it normal. Please don't. Please fight back against this becoming accepted or tolerated in any sense. We need to do something fast because it's only getting worse. Meanwhile, in India, they're setting records as well, this time in the area of cracking down on people's free ability to communicate over the internet. Let's talk about their shutdown of the internet in Kashmir. India imposed the shutdown back on August 5th when authorities revoked Kashmir's autonomy and statehood, snapped all communications, and detained the region's mainstream politicians. So effectively, for the vast majority of the people there, aside from a few businesses that were given specific license to use the internet, it was shut off. And that shutdown It's now, well, it's 134th day on Monday. It's several days more than that. It's now the longest ever imposed in a democracy. There have been authoritarian regimes such as China and Myanmar that have cut off the internet for longer, but India is a democracy. This is not the only internet shutoff they've done, but this is now record breaking for this form of government. And so let's talk about the effect. What does this actually do if you are trying to live and work, have a regular life in the area that's been shut down? So they're unable to operate online businesses. In early December, they began disappearing from WhatsApp. These are individual accounts because accounts are automatically deleted after 120 days of inactivity. Journalists rely on a government-run center with just 10 computers to file their stories. The Kashmir Chamber of Commerce estimates $1.4 billion in losses already. And so if you are trying to operate a business, if you're trying to communicate with people outside of the country, that has been incredibly difficult now for months and months. And India's foreign minister has defended the shutdown, saying it's being used to disrupt activity by militant groups that India accuses Pakistan of supporting. That was the initial argument. It is still being used. For the people who are just trying to live their lives, though, it seems like they're going pretty far to crack down on this communication, because lots of other normal sorts of communication are also stopped. And it's having not just negative consequences, but fatal consequences. In July, urologist Omar Saleem saw a patient who had advanced stage pancreatic cancer. He contacted fellow specialists in Mumbai to consult on possible treatments. Then communication was cut off. The patient died in November. Now, the patient might have died anyway. We don't know, though, because he wasn't able to get the help that he needed, because communication was shut off. The internet is not just for fun, you know. It's serious. It's serious on the business side. It's serious for communication. Journalists need access to the outside world. Doctors need access to the outside world. Academics need access to the outside world. It's pretty important, and thus really, really bad when a democracy shuts it off for this long. It's so bad, by the way, that a lot of regular people, there's a train that takes people outside of the region to an area that does have internet, and it is packed constantly by people just trying to maintain their lives. On a recent foggy morning, it was full of people hoping to renew driver's licenses, apply for passports, fill out admissions forms, and check email. They included 16-year-old Kushbu Yakub, who was rushing to register for a medical school exam. He said, "If I had any other option, I wouldn't be here." These people are having to take trains just to do the normal sort of bureaucratic stuff that makes up a life. And that continues. It's even more of a record than it was a few days ago. Meanwhile, in Bangladesh, Lululemon is in some trouble. Now, the Canadian brand recently launched a partnership with the United Nations Foundation to reduce stress levels and promote the mental health of aid workers. So, doing some good stuff. But there is some stress for people who are sourcing clothing in Bangladesh for Lululemon. They are being treated absolutely horrendously while producing clothes that will eventually be sold in Lululemon stores internationally and enjoyed in people, particularly in LA, by the way. So, here are some of the claims that factory workers have made. Factory workers who break any rules or leave earlier than expected are verbally abused by management and hit. Some said they have been made to work despite ill health. Some laborers are paid less than £85 a month. That is less than the price of one pair of Lululemon leggings. They're forced to work overtime to hit targets, saying they sometimes felt immense pressure not to leave their workstations. They faced physical violence and regular humiliation at the hands of their managers, who literally will hit them and also launch misogynistic attacks against them. Here is one individual's experience. She said, "I was sick, so one day I left work at 5 p.m., but I informed the line supervisor. He told his bosses I left without telling anyone, and the next day when I went to work, the technician in charge of my line slapped me. He slapped me so hard my cheeks turned red and everyone asked me what happened. I couldn't tell them the actual story, I just told them I had allergies." She claimed she didn't complain as she felt no one would care, and she added that female workers were also called prostitutes. One other example, during last Ramadan, they created a new line and recruited new female workers. One day, a technician hit a label operator so hard on her chest, we could see she was in pain the whole day. She was lying in the back of the line for hours, but our bosses did nothing about her. Now, Lululemon has put out a statement saying there are currently no orders planned for this factory, and we will take appropriate actions based upon the findings of our investigation. At the end of the day, this isn't just about this factory, it's not just about Lululemon. Like, this is a thing, we've known about this stuff for years and years and years. It isn't stopping, it still continues. For some of the biggest brands in the world, it continues, and we need to take it seriously. Okay, that's all the time we have, unfortunately. Thank you so much for joining me. There will be live coverage of the debates later on tonight. I will be a part of that, so please tune in right after they finish. We'll be giving live commentary. Should be a lot of fun, so I'll see you then. Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adirola. I'll see you soon.